You are Locked On Orioles, your daily podcast on the Baltimore Orioles, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Locked On Orioles, your place for Orioles news and analysis from the clubhouse to the warehouse and beyond. As always, I'm your host, Justin McGuire. I'm a veteran journalist who spent 8 years as a senior editor at Sporting News. I'm a former Cy Young and Rookie of the Year voter, and I'm a longtime Orioles fan. On today's episode, we're going to be joined by Luke Jones, who's the Orioles beat reporter for WNST Radio. Luke and I talked about Tanner Scott, about whether the Orioles really have any interest in handling Ramirez, and a couple of other things. We'll get to that in just a second. First, though, I want to mention, though, that while the Orioles didn't play last night, they did make some news. With the 11th pick in the first round of the MLB draft, they selected Grayson Rodriguez, a right-handed pitcher out of high school in Texas. I don't pretend to know a whole lot about Rodriguez. He's not a name that I had seen tied to the Orioles before last night. But from what I can see, he was not projected to go as high as 11. So maybe this is a bit of a reach for the Orioles. We don't know. Of course, high school pitchers take a long time to develop, and it'll be a while before we really know whether this is a good pick or not. Hunter Harvey, for example, was selected in 2013, and he has yet to pitch an inning in the majors. So maybe several years before we know whether Grayson Rodriguez is going to make an impact for the Orioles. In any case, though, we're going to have a full breakdown of Rodriguez and the rest of the Orioles draft picks with Luke Seiler, who will join us Wednesday. So be sure to check that episode out. One other thing I wanted to mention, I think all of you guys know that I have another podcast called Baseball by the Book. An episode that I put out Monday features an interview with Eric Sherman, who collaborated with Davey Johnson on his autobiography. Davey Johnson, as I'm sure most of you know, was a second baseman for the Orioles in their 1966 and 1970 World Series championship teams. He was later the manager of the Orioles and led them to postseason appearances in 1996 and 1997. So my interview with Sherman touches on a lot of Orioles-related topics, including Johnson's relationship with Peter Angelos and a lot of other stuff. So I'd encourage you guys to check that out if you're interested. You can find Baseball by the Book wherever you get your podcasts, and just look for episode 140. We're going to get to our interview with Luke Jones after this. Hey folks, just a reminder, for all the original content of the Locked On Podcast Network, both the podcasts and the written content on every team, go to LockedOnSports.com. And of course, for all your content on the Baltimore Orioles, make sure to go to LockedOnOrioles.com. Welcome back, everybody. We are joined by Luke Jones now. He is the Orioles beat reporter for WNST Radio. Welcome, Luke.
How are you, Justin?
I'm doing well. I'm doing better than the Orioles, I think, anyway, but most people are. Luke, you know, you follow this team. You're around them all the time, and you know as well as any of us that this is just a terrible, horrible season. I'm sure it's not a lot of fun in the clubhouse right now. I'm sure it's certainly not a lot of fun to be a fan right now, and I would imagine being a media member isn't a lot of fun either. But they have had a couple of bright spots. We've touched on a few of those in previous episodes. But one thing I wanted to ask you about was a guy who, on the surface, maybe isn't having a great year, but if you look underneath a little bit, he's been pretty effective, and that's Tanner Scott. Can you talk a little bit about how good Tanner Scott has been if you look closely enough?
Yeah, it's interesting because he's a guy that has been talked about for the last few years. I mean, a left-handed reliever, so right there off the bat, there's some, you know, perceived value because, you know, we know basically anyone that's left-handed and has a pulse has a chance, you know, in professional baseball, and they're gonna try everything they can to extract value there just because it's, you know, you don't have a ton of guys like that. But his reputation in the minor leagues, I mean, first of all, he's 23 years old, so still a young player. Has always thrown hard, but if you look, go back to from the time that he started with the Orioles in this organization, he was 19 years old in 2014, always had great strikeout numbers, but you'd look at the walks per nine innings and it just make you cringe. I mean, even going back to 2016, he was with Bowie and Frederick, he averaged 11.3 strikeouts per nine innings, but also eight walks per nine innings. So the Orioles have done some interesting things with him the last couple years. They even put him into a starting role, not because they really thought he was going to become a starter, but more so giving him a little bit more of a regimented routine to see if that would help him be able to work on his control a little bit more than just being thrown in high-leverage situations like a kid with his kind of an arm is going to be thrown into at the minor league level. And I think it's really started to pay some dividends. I mean, even last year, which the Orioles called him up in September, he had a cup of coffee. He only had a couple appearances. But if you look at his numbers for Bowie in 2017, the walk rate had improved, but was still six per nine innings. So this is a kid who's come a long way. You look at him right now, and he's had a couple stints. As you know, with the Orioles, they always play the Norfolk train as far as any pitchers in their bullpen with options. They're just going to be cycled in and out because, well, they don't have a great staff. They don't have a great starting rotations. But the last few weeks, he's kind of settled in, and you've even seen him pitch in maybe not high-leverage situations, but some medium-leverage situations for them, as few as the Orioles might have with their record. And he's averaging 11.3 strikeouts per nine innings. The walk rate is down to 3.8 per nine innings. That works. That will play right there. I mean, this is a kid who can hit 100 miles per hour. He's routinely sitting in the 90s and can consistently hit the high 90s. And he's got a really good slider to go with it that's right around 89, 90, 91. So it really speaks to how good the arm is. He has a changeup he's working on. That's still more of a show-me pitch, still something he's that is a work in progress. But I think you look at all the peripherals other than the ERA, which is still 4.4. It's not like it's been terrible, but you just see a maturation there. And even this Yankees series this past weekend, he gives up a long home run to Aaron Judge. You know, made a mistake, which lots of pitchers do against Aaron Judge. But then he bounced back and ended up striking out Greg Bird and Giancarlo Stanton to finish off the inning. So you like seeing that. You like seeing a kid who has some failure because all pitchers are going to have that. But then he gets right back on the horse and strikes out two other very dangerous major league hitters. So of all the horrendous things that you can talk about with the Orioles right now, and it's really difficult to find bright spots, Tanner Scott has been one of those. Now, it's not a finished product. He's probably still going to go through some woes, and I would even expect he'll probably go through a couple stints where the control reverts a little bit and regresses a little bit. But the overall progress you've seen him make in the minor leagues to now being on this major league roster, being in this bullpen, he's very much someone you can point to. And if you tell me right now he's going to be their closer two or three years from now, I wouldn't bat an eyelash because Tanner Scott's really making some nice progress.
Yeah, and of course, I suppose one of the nice things or one of the, I guess, the silver linings to having a team that's bad is you can throw him out there and not worry about him blowing important situations because you're not fighting for a pennant. You know, you're not, this isn't a team where a loss here or there might cost them a postseason bid like, you know, if it was 2016 or something. So they have a little margin for error, which I get, which allows them to showcase these guys a little bit more and find out what they're capable of.
Yeah, and that is the silver lining right now. And I guess on the flip side, you can say, well, if he's not going to be pitching in a lot of big games and everything, there's still going to be a little bit of an unknown there. If and when the Orioles are competitive again a couple years from now, and you certainly hope it's sooner rather than later, but I think we all look at this organization and have some serious doubts. But it is a case where you just look at the reality. Zach Britton should be back, if all things go to plan, over the next 10 days or so. The target return date for him is right around June 14th, June 15th, if his next few rehab assignments stints and appearances go well. They want to have him take a back-to-back next week, and then they'll see how he responds to that. But all signs have been encouraging there. Darren O'Day, same thing with him. Brad Brock has pitched better since a really, really shaky April. So it's very clear with this team being in rebuilding mode, I would think they're going to try to move at least Britton. I think they're very much going to try to move Brock, and I think there'll be some interest in him, even if they're not going to net lucrative returns for those guys. And you know, O'Day has one more year left on his contract. That's going to be a little more problematic to move. But the point being, they're going to have some openings in this bullpen for some other arms to step into some higher leverage roles. We've seen Richard Bleier do that out of sheer necessity because of some of the injuries they've had in their bullpen. Michael Gibbons is still there, and you know, he's kind of had an up and down year, but I think the body of work, you're still encouraged there. But Tanner Scott, there's going to be an opportunity for him to slide into a seventh or eighth inning role on what's going to be a really bad team the rest of the season. So it's a good opportunity for him. And you know, right now, as much as you want to point to youth for this ball club right now, there's not a ton of guys at the minor league level right now that are on the cusp of being ready. You know, you're seeing it at a catcher right now, Chance Sisko. They're calling up Austin Wins, who's 27 years old, a defense-first catcher who swung the bat okay at Norfolk this year. But most of their other guys, other than maybe a Cedric Mullins, who is a center fielder who just got promoted from AA Bowie up to Norfolk this past week, most of their other guys that you're kind of that are on the radar are still Delmarva, Frederick, Bowie. So as much as you want a youth movement, just because you're tired of seeing some of the retreads and veterans who have no future with this team from a winning context, you still have to field a 25-man roster, and I think it's bad business to promote guys that aren't ready just because you want to see something different. So I think in the case of guys like Tanner Scott and Chance Cisco and Austin Wins, and maybe Mullins later this year, maybe Austin Hayes later this year if he swings the bat a little bit better at Bowie, they'll have some opportunities. But you know, in the interim, you only have a handful of guys right now that you're pointing to that are young and that you feel really good about. And ironically, the one guy that's still 25 years old, Manny Machado, is, you know, we know the story there. So you're looking for some of these young guys to get some opportunities and not just get those, but to take advantage. And like I said, Tanner Scott's done a nice job in that regard.
Yeah, and you've touched on something that I think has been a great source of frustration for Orioles fans beyond, you know, just the fact that this team is 17-41 or whatever they are right now. But you see this on Twitter a lot, and I understand the frustration, but I think you put your finger on why this isn't a good way to go. A lot of people are sick of seeing the Gentrys and the Rickards and the Jace Petersons and like you said, these retreads, these guys who aren't going to do anything in the future. They're just kind of basically, you know, minor league players masquerading as major leaguers to this point. And a lot of people are saying, get rid of these guys and bring up the prospects. But like you said, most of the prospects aren't really ready yet for this kind to be in the major leagues. You know, Ryan Mountcastle's having a nice year, but they're not ready to bring him up yet. They want to wait a little bit on that. You know, Cedric Mullins, maybe he may be ready later in the year, but I don't think there's any reason to rush him right now. You want to let these guys develop in the minor leagues and give them a chance when they're ready, because there's really no reason to throw them into this horrible situation. And the result of that is Orioles fans are just going to have to deal with the fact that there's a lot of bad major league players on this roster the rest of the year. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's just the reality right now. As difficult as it is to say this, I don't say this to be flippant about it, because it's very clear that this frustration isn't just based on emotion. It's not irrational. It's completely rational frustration with where this team is. And even for people who were saying a year or two ago to start thinking about the future so they wouldn't be in this position with Machado or with Zach Britton, or, you know, you can even talk about Jonathan Scope, who is free agency, by the way, is a year away. But that said, you can only make these moves once, and, you know, that goes for firing people, that goes for trading Machado. You know, that's why I've said, you know, all along, yeah, in a vacuum, you'd like to trade him now, because that perceived value is going to be greater for 3.5 months of him rather than 2 months, but you want to make the best deal, not the earliest deal. And it's really the same thing when you talk about all these prospects. I mean, there is, you know, the Orioles system isn't completely bare. Does that mean it's top half of baseball? No. Does it? That mean it doesn't need to improve markedly? I mean, of course it does. But they do have some players. But that said, you can't let what's going on in Baltimore completely get you off track with what the best situation, the best plan of attack is for each of these individual prospects, each of these minor leaguers, and just throw them into a situation where you say sink or swim at the major league level. Now, you know, people will point to examples like Manny Machado in 2012, who was at Bowie at the time, wasn't even raking at Bowie, if you recall. You go back and look at his numbers, they weren't all that great. He had played, I think, 2 games at third base, but you're talking about a generational talent there. So that doesn't want to, you don't want to do that with guys like Mountcastle, guys like Ryan McKenna, who was just named the minor league player of the month for the Orioles, and actually looks like he could be a real center field prospect for them. But these are guys that are at, you know, single A and double A, and you don't want to just throw them into the major league level just because you're really frustrated with seeing the same guys who have no future with this team. So I think, you know, I've seen a few people offer this sentiment on Twitter, so I don't want to take credit for it. But, you know, if you're really, really frustrated with what you're seeing with the Orioles right now, the best solution isn't just to call up every single prospect who's has some inkling of being on the radar. The best solution might be to go check out some minor league games where these guys are playing, or get an MILB.com subscription. Invest a little bit more in watching some of these guys at the single A level, the double A level, and then you see how they develop. I think there's a collection of players, specifically in the outfield. You mentioned Mountcastle. I think the big question with him is, where is he going to play? They've already moved him from short to third, and there's very, very much a lot of skepticism whether he can handle third base even. But I think there's a collection of guys they have that have a chance to be major league players. Maybe not a Machado type, maybe not a guy that becomes an all-star like Scope did a year ago, but I think there's some guys. But you got to let this play out, and it's frustrating as anything for Orioles fans to watch this major league club right now, but you can't make decisions based on frustration. That's just going to do any of these players a disservice and hinder their ability to reach their full potential, which you hope will be major league contributors at some point here in the not too distant future.
All right. Well, shifting gears a little bit, over the weekend, we saw a report from our old pal, Ken Rosenthal, that he works for The Athletic now, but he was indicating that the Orioles had some interest in Hanley Ramirez, who, of course, the Red Sox just released. And I think, my initial instinct on that and the initial instinct of most people I saw on Twitter was, that's insane. Like, there's literally no reason the Orioles should be thinking about any kind of veterans like that at this point in a lost season already. Have you heard anything about this? Is this a real possibility? I know Ken Rosenthal is a good reporter, and I can't imagine he didn't have solid sources on that, but it just seems so ridiculous. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I know, it's been confirmed by a number of outlets that that the Orioles are at least considering it. Now, if you cover Dan Duquette, you know that he generally kind of speaks in generalities, and he kind of has an unorthodox way of communicating with reporters. And does it mean they're going to sign him? No. And I would honestly question the flip side of this. If you're Hanley Ramirez, who right now is sitting home and being paid a boatload of money by the Boston Red Sox to not be on their 25-man roster, why wouldn't you just keep yourself in shape and have your agent continue to work the phones and wait this out a little bit to see if there's a perceived contender with a first baseman or DH that gets hurt? I can't see why Hanley Ramirez would be in a position where he's eager to join a team that is, flirting with 25 games below 500, and we're not even the flag day yet. But I think the one thing you could say, if you're making an argument for this, and look, I'm much more inclined to say, what are you really doing here? I mean, what purpose does this really serve? I guess the one thing you could say is it's not as though they have a first base DH type at AAA right now that's ready to be called up. They don't have a Vlad Guerrero Jr. that you're just kind of waiting and seeing, why isn't this kid being called up? So if you bring him in, I don't know where he fits exactly. I mean, do you put him at DH? And that means more right field opportunities for Mark Trumbo, which I think makes you cringe if you've watched him in the outfield, really over the course of his entire career. But there's an argument, I suppose, to be made if you bring him in and Hanley kind of has a little bit of a rejuvenation with a fresh start and he hits well for 4 weeks. Maybe you could flip him at the deadline and get a C-plus prospect, but I don't know. I mean, this team already has five first base DH types as it is. They have Trey Mancini in left field, who I like Trey a lot, and I know he's struggling at the plate, and I think some of this might go back to when he ran his knee into the wall trying to make a catch down the left field line back in April. But he's not a left fielder, and I think that's become apparent, and that's not his fault. He was a first baseman through college and the minor league level, so I don't really like the idea of throwing another first base DH type in the mix there. And I would assume if you would, that would mean you're waving goodbye to Pedro Alvarez, maybe Danny Valencia, even though Valencia, you can make an argument, has been their second or third best hitter on this team, which shows the state of affairs for Baltimore. But it really does feel like one of those things where, is this really where your attention should be devoted to right now? I get it. They're focused on the draft over the course of this week. So maybe you're not looking, maybe trades aren't your top priority until you get into the second week of June. But it still really does feel, it's a head-scratching kind of thing to even say that you're considering it, even if you're just saying you're considering it in a way that you generically say, well, we'll consider anything that we think could make us better. It still feels peculiar, which is probably the kindest way you could describe the state of the Orioles right now.
Yes, peculiar. Peculiar is definitely one way to describe the Orioles' decision-making process. I think that's safe to say in all things. All right. Well, thanks a lot. I'd love to have you back on as we get closer to the trade deadline and we start looking at what the Orioles might do with Manny Machado and Brad Brock and Zach Britton and maybe Adam Jones and some of the others. I think that's going to be, at least for the for the next few months, that's going to be the most exciting thing about the Orioles is looking at who they might be trading and what they might be getting for them. So we'd love to have you back on to discuss that as we get closer to the deadline.
I'd be happy to do that, Justin. Always enjoy talking. And yeah, maybe the next time we talk, there'll be a little more clarity. But my biggest question I keep asking is, who exactly is making the call on these trades? And that, to me, is more paramount than Machado or anyone else at this point, which is not a good thing when you're the worst team in baseball and this season's already over from a win-loss standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, we've had this discussion on this podcast numerous times about that very question of who's really in charge in the warehouse. You've got the Angelos, you've got his sons, you've got Brady Anderson, you've got Dan Duquette, and of course Buck Showalter factors in there somewhere. So it really is kind of a mess, and I think that's at the heart of a lot of the problems the Orioles have, is that they organizationally, they just don't seem to have their act together. I'll put you that way.
No question about it. And it'll definitely be a soap opera that has played out already and will continue to play out over the next few months as we get closer to the end of the season. And then who's going to be running the team next year? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about all that stuff in the coming months. All right, thanks a lot, Luke.
Thanks, Justin.
And that's going to do it for another edition of Locked On Orioles. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.